In this last session, we'll look at the fourth of the four types of mental balance, is emotional balance. So we've looked at motivational balance as the basis, on that basis to develop our attentional balance. And then with attentional balance, with a calm, clear, focused mind, we can really then work on the other two aspects of mental balance, cognitive balance, which we looked at in the last session, and in this session, emotional balance. And here, emotional balance is, it's achieved when one has awareness of one's own and others' emotions, emotional triggers, and emotional behaviors as they arise, and making wise choices while engaging with emotional experience. Like the other three areas, the imbalances can be characterized in terms of deficit, hyperactivity, and dysfunctional. So in deficit, in terms of emotional balance, is simply to really sort of cut from experience and have this sort of cold, aloof indifference. Then, of course, hyperactivity is over reacting, particularly with things like attachment and aversion. And then, of course, dysfunctional means to engage in inappropriate responses to situations. So how to cultivate emotional balance, we're going to look at here is in terms of what's called the four immeasurables. So the four immeasurables are four qualities we are trying to cultivate so that we can avoid these types of imbalance when we are responding to situations. The first is loving kindness, which is a translation of maitri in Sanskrit and Pali metta. So loving kindness is simply defined as the wish for ourselves and others to be happy, or in other words, the wish for ourselves and others to have happiness and its causes. Now, here we need to be very clear about two things. One is the term. Often this word maitri and metta is translated as love. But I think here that can be a little bit misleading, because for us the word love in the English language often implies some sort of intimate behavior, and love is definitely an emotion. Where actually technically here, when we're talking about maitri and metta, it's not a behavior, and it's not even really an emotion. Maitri or metta is an aspiration, it's a wish. It's a wish for ourselves and others to be happy. So therefore, it's probably better to translate this as loving kindness rather than as love. So again, loving kindness is the wish for ourselves and others to have happiness and its causes. Now, also, what is important here is to distinguish this from attachment. Because particularly when we look in the cognitive balance area, we're really talking about not only seeing reality clearly, but through that eliminating all of our mental afflictions, including, of course, attachment. So here we're talking about cultivating and increasing loving kindness, and at the same time we're talking about reducing and eliminating attachment. And often there's a lot of confusion here. One is the attachment, is that often people feel like attachment's sort of necessary, that if I get rid of attachment, and we relate back to just our simple pleasures we talked a bit about before, often people feel if they get rid of attachment, somehow life will become bland and boring. But actually, it's the exact opposite. Particularly if we develop, as we saw earlier, the attention skills and the cognitive balance, what we'll find is that we'll be more present when we have some simple, pleasurable experience. And because of also developing cognitive balance, this will reduce and eliminate attachment. And actually, we'll enjoy those pleasurable experiences more. Because, and we probably know this from our own experience, is that often when we have very strong craving for some sort of pleasurable experience, that strong craving tends to agitate our mind quite a lot, to the point where we get sometimes anxiety thinking, oh, I'm not going to get that thing. Or if I get the thing, we often even have some anxiety, am I going to get enough of it or am I going to lose it? So actually, this craving and attachment really interferes with our enjoyment of that simple pleasure. Whereas if we can, through attention training and cognitive training, reduce attachment, what that means, of course, is that when we have that simple pleasure, it doesn't mean somehow we're not going to enjoy it. But because of that attention and cognitive training, our mind will be more calm, more present, we'll actually enjoy that pleasure much more than we do now without this sort of anxiety or worry about, am I going to get it? Am I going to get enough? Am I going to lose it? And also what we find is attachment is always looking at things in terms of, I hope that's going to make me happy. And attachment is never satisfied with anything. So attachment's always looking for something bigger, better, and different. Bigger, better, different. So actually, if we have attachment, not only can that lead to a lot of anxiety and craving and interfering with our pleasure, but if it's something that we often experience, then after some time, attachment's going to go, no, sorry, that's not good enough anymore. I want something bigger, better, different. So not only does attachment interfere with our pleasures, but it really then turns things that we enjoy usually often into things that are now somehow boring. And we know that. If there's something we really enjoy, but we get it a lot, after some time we go, that's not really much of interest anymore. I want something bigger, better, different. Whereas if we can get rid of that attachment, we can enjoy those simple pleasures much more than we do now and continue to enjoy them. So therefore, we shouldn't think that by reducing attachment, somehow we're not going to enjoy the simple pleasures in life. But in particular, I want to talk about attachment here in the context of loving kindness. Because often when we talk about getting rid of attachment or reducing attachment, another doubt that often comes up is, oh, but then somehow there's no basis for any relationship anymore. I need attachments in relationships, for sure. But what we need to understand is that here there are two dynamics going on. There is the loving kindness dynamic and the attachment dynamic, and they're usually mixed together. And so we are to distinguish these two dynamics and understand that the loving kindness part of the dynamic is very healthy and to cultivate that, whereas the attachment part of the dynamic is not healthy and we need to reduce that. And the way to distinguish the two is that attachment is all about me, 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 me. Whereas in a relationship, of course, the loving kindness is about wishing that person to be happy. And of course, the small print, the fine print of that is wishing them to be happy without expecting anything in return. You know, the no strings attached love, unconditional love. Strings attached love is love or loving kindness sort of polluted by attachment. And that sort of sounds like, you know, I will love you as long as, and here comes the condition from attachment, as long as you keep saying and doing things that make me happy. I'll love you that long. If you don't, I'm going to stop it. So that's all attachment speaking. So very simply, the way to distinguish the two is love or loving kindness is saying, I want you to be happy. Attachment is saying, I want you to make me happy. So that the more attachment we have in relationship, the more problematic it's going to be. So therefore, we need to distinguish these two dynamics, increase the healthy one, decrease the unhealthy one. Now, of course, the reality is that attachment pervades our life. So it's not a matter of going, okay, by next week I'm going to get rid of all of my attachment. This is just not going to happen. In fact, in Buddhism, it's said that we live in this desire realm because the main thing that's pervading our existence is craving attachment. So from a Buddhist perspective, we'll only eliminate attachment fully when we've transcended the whole lot and we've achieved liberation. But certainly to try and reduce it as much as possible. And then also the other point here that sometimes creates confusion is that within this, we talk about in Buddhism often, you know, to love everyone equally. And then also people have some confusion about that. Because again, here, we're not talking about having equal behavior, spending equal amount of time with people. That's not what's meant here. So what we're talking about when we say equal, love everyone equally, we're talking about having an equal attitude towards everyone. To equally have the attitude of wishing others to be happy. That's what immeasurable loving kindness means, is that we have that wish equally to everyone. How we implement that attitude will depend on the relationship. To partner, of course, you spend a lot of time, maybe express that in a very intimate way. To our family members, maybe less time, express that in a different way. And then to work colleagues and neighbours and so forth, that same attitude, we maybe spend hardly any time and express it in a very different way. So we're talking about the equal attitude, not equal time or equal behaviour. That really wouldn't work. So this is loving kindness. And very similar to this, we have compassion. In Sanskrit, karuna. So compassion is the wish for ourselves and others to be free of suffering. So here in the four immeasurables, of course, this word immeasurable is talking about immeasurable living beings, meaning we're cultivating these four qualities towards all living beings. Now, generally, loving kindness and compassion, when we're cultivating this, it's recommended we cultivate these in stages, that we first cultivate them to people most easy, the so-called friends. Once we're comfortable with that, then we can expand it out to people we don't know very well, so-called strangers. Then we can start to expand it out to people who find it a little bit difficult, the so-called enemy, and then towards all living beings. So these are usually the stages of cultivation that are described. But I think in our modern society, we need to add one more step at the very beginning. And that's often not mentioned in the text. And that is to cultivate loving kindness and compassion to ourselves first. Because unfortunately, in our modern society, seems to be an epidemic of low self-esteem, even self-hatred. So if we're not kind and compassionate to ourselves, of course, we're not going to be able to extend that out to others. So therefore, we can cultivate these in those stages. Then the third quality is empathetic joy, or mudita in Sanskrit. And empathetic joy is a rejoicing in our own and others' virtues and good fortune. And I think this also is something desperately in need in our modern society. Because unfortunately in our modern society, we always seem to focus on the negative. And we therefore end up with a lopsided, unbalanced, biased view of ourselves and others because we're always focusing on the negative. Whereas Empathetic joy, of course, is focusing on the positive aspects of ourselves and others. So to help balance our view of ourselves and others, it's important to focus on the positive aspects. And this empathetic joy is a rejoicing in our own and others' virtues and good fortune. So I think this is very much in need in our modern society. And then the last quality is equanimity, or in Sanskrit, upeksha. And equanimity here is an impartial attitude towards everyone. It's a sort of sense of closeness to everyone. Now, of course, we're very biased in our attitude towards others. And we tend to categorize people into three groups simply in terms of how they affect me and my happiness. So to those people around us who seem to support me and my happiness, we label friend. To those people around us who don't seem to affect me and my happiness in any way, stranger. And those people around us who seem to interfere with me and my happiness and maybe even cause me suffering, so-called enemy. So we tend to categorize people into these three groups simply from the perspective of how are they affecting me. And then, of course, to the friends, we end up with a lot of attachment because they seem like they're the source of our happiness. To the stranger, who don't seem to be affecting me in any way, we often become very apathetic and indifferent. And to the so-called enemy, who seem to be interfering with me and my happiness, often a lot of aversion, hostility, anger, or even hatred. So we end up with attachment to friends, apathy to strangers, hostility, anger, hatred to the enemy or difficult people. Equanimity is about overcoming this biased attitude by understanding that we're all in the same situation. We're all struggling to be happy, to be free of suffering. We're all in the same situation. And on that basis, to develop this sense of closeness to everyone. We're all equal in wanting to be happy, wanting to be free of suffering. Now, I was going to bring it up later, but I think maybe it's a good time to bring it in here, is, again, in this model, we've seen a little bit that based on developing our attention skills, we can better develop our cognitive balance by coming to experience and realize nature of reality. But also, of course, with attention skills, in emotional balance, we can better come to cultivate these qualities in daily life and in meditation. But also, there's very much an interplay between cognitive and emotional balance. Because often in Buddhism, it's said there are two main aspects of practice. What's often said to be like two wings of the practice: wisdom and compassion. So wisdom, of course, is cognitive balance, and the compassion wing is really what we're talking about here, the emotional balance. So just like a bird needs two wings to fly, we need to cultivate these equally, together. Unfortunately, in many people who enter a spiritual path, they tend to gravitate to either the wisdom wing or the compassion wing, and sort of forget about the other wing. So, of course, we understand in Buddhism this cognitive balance is very important, this idea of the Vipassana practice, because that's what's going to really liberate us. So then often people put a lot of effort into this and sort of forget about this side of the practice. And then, unfortunately, what often happens is that the very nature of that cognitive training is that people tend to become very self-absorbed, become often very disconnected, and often become actually very insensitive to the sufferings of others. And in some extreme cases, because they believe they're doing some high-level Vipassana wisdom practice, they believe that they've gone beyond ethics. You know, ethics, that's a stuff for beginners. I'm a Vipassana practitioner, so everything I do is with wisdom, so everything I do is fine. And they delude themselves and then end up in very unethical behavior. So that can be one thing that can happen if we don't complement the cognitive balance with the emotional balance, with the that side. But equally, we can have the other effect. Often people enter into spiritual practice and gravitate towards the compassion wing and sort of forget about the wisdom wing. And then often find themselves in a lot of difficulty there as well. Because with this compassion wing, then often we can become, as we saw here, if we don't particularly emphasize equanimity, which is really based on wisdom a lot, is that our compassion can become very biased. You know, I'll help these people because they're nice people. I'm not going to help those people because they're nasty, horrible people. In fact, I hope they suffer. They deserve to suffer. But also, of course, what can happen is without wisdom, if we try and help people, sometimes we create a big mess that actually we create more suffering than was there before. And that can often become because we don't really understand how to help. Skillful means. So that involves often a lot of wisdom to know how to help people. But also what can often happen, and this unfortunately happens with people who have high level of compassion, really want to go out and fix and heal the world and really make a big change in the world, full of enthusiasm, full of compassion, go out there, and then often within 3 to 6 months, compassion burnout. And unfortunately we see this in like aid workers, social workers, and so forth. And this is a classic example of compassion without the wisdom. So the wisdom here, of course, is the wisdom of knowing what we can do to help, what we can't do to help, and the wisdom of knowing when to rest and look after ourselves so we can avoid compassion burnout. And then there's one other case that probably all of us experience many occasions is we try to help someone and then they take advantage of us. So again, this is a classic example of compassion without wisdom. Because actually, if we try to help someone and we allow them to take advantage of us, we are actually encouraging them to behave in a bad way, in an unethical manner. That's not very compassionate. So therefore, the wisdom is to not allow that to happen. That if someone's trying to take advantage of our good nature, is to be very firm about that behavior. Still, of course, having compassion for the person, but be very forceful about their trying to take advantage of us. So these reasons, I think it's very important to cultivate these two together. And of course, the more that we cultivate this, the more that will be a basis for cognitive training. And the more that we cultivate the cognitive training and reduce the self-grasping, the more that will feed into this as well. So they'll not only support each other, but they'll help be the basis of each other as well. Now, oh, there's a question here.
Okay.
One point that I want to mention here that related to this that I think is very important, and that is, again, to do with this idea that each of these four elements interact and support and help each other, is here in this emotional balance, often people find it very difficult when it comes to loving kindness and compassion for two types of people. Most commonly, of course, to cultivate loving kindness and compassion to people who behave badly. And then secondly, sometimes even having loving kindness and compassion for ourselves. And often the reason we find that very difficult is because of cognitive imbalance. And I'll show what I mean by that. So if someone's behaving badly, then the correct perspective is simply to acknowledge there is a person who is doing or engaging in some bad or harmful behavior. So this is the correct perspective. So cognitively speaking, this is correct. There is a person engaging in a harmful behavior. But often when we see that, often cognitively, that's not the perspective that we often take. Often we take the perspective there is a bad person. So what we've done is we've cognitively fused the person to the behavior and made them one thing. And this in psychology is often called cognitive fusion. So cognitively speaking, this is of course a wrong perspective, an invalid perspective, to fuse these two elements and make them one thing. Because there's two things here. There's a person and their behavior. If we do the cognitive fusion, then we're in trouble. Then the emotional balance becomes very difficult. Because if we do cognitive fusion, well, in general, in any situation, there are two options available to us. Either accept or reject. And generally, if someone's behaving badly, it's reject. We reject. But if we do cognitive fusion and we see as a bad person, then when we reject, we end up attacking the person. And if we understand that attacking the person is not a very helpful thing, then the only other option, if we don't reject, is accept. But if we do the cognitive fusion, then what accept translates into is accepting their bad behavior. So, of course, both of these are not very helpful. But these are really the only two options available to us if we do cognitive fusion. But it's actually much worse than that, because if we do the cognitive fusion, not only do we react in this way, but then because we've fused the person to their behavior and we see them as a bad person, we end up with a completely biased view of the person, because it becomes very difficult to acknowledge anything good that they do, because bad people don't do good things. So we get a completely biased, lopsided view of that person as a bad person, and we can't really even acknowledge any of their good qualities. And then, of course, when it comes to then emotional balance, out the window, because we get angry at them, we attack them, or we simply accept their bad behavior and they take advantage of us, big mess. So, therefore, when we try to do have forgiveness or compassion, not only is it difficult, it actually feels wrong. Because to have forgiveness or compassion for a bad person feels like what we're saying, oh, what you did is okay, I don't mind. Of course we should mind. But if we do cognitive fusion, that's what forgiveness or compassion feels like. So not only do we find it difficult, we often find they don't deserve it because they're a bad person. They don't deserve compassion. So, of course, the simple answer is don't do cognitive fusion, which is an invalid perspective. So if we work on our cognitive balance and simply see the correct perspective, there is a person who's engaging in a harmful behavior, then we can reject their behavior and at the same time accept the person. So by accepting the person, we can have compassion for the person. And at the same time, not accept their bad behavior, not tolerate their bad behavior, and address their bad behavior. And try and help that person to overcome their negative, harmful behavior. And then, of course, with the correct perspective, we can have a balanced view of them. Because now this person is engaging in harmful behavior, but I can equally see there's a person engaging in a beneficial behavior. So we can have a balanced, correct view of that person. So here again, if we don't work on the cognitive balance, if we really end up in this cognitive fusion, then it becomes very difficult to develop the emotional balance because we end up in this difficulty here. Unfortunately, of course, we've grown up with cognitive fusion. And our society seems to really promote this wrong perspective. So we need to really put some effort in the way we think and the way we speak in terms of not thinking and speaking in this way, because that will easily lead to this scenario and will be make it difficult for us to develop compassion for others. So if we really start to work on our cognitive training and really come to see things correctly, there is a person engaging in some sort of harmful behavior, then we can develop the emotional balance much more easily in a good, valid way and help that person to overcome that negative behavior. So there was a question at the back there.
What happens? Just simply relabel the bad person.
Sorry?
What I'm saying is, I will still go along with the cognitive fusion, but I will relabel, instead of saying that person is a bad person, I will say he's an imperfect person. Because everybody is imperfect, I'm no self. I'm the same good as the other person. Equal as the other person.
Yeah.
So I can develop compassion for another person, for that person, the bad person, I call it the imperfect person, and I will try to help the person.
Right.
That is, if the person is a really rotten to the core, for example, I'm saying about terrorists or imagine, Hitler, do we still cultivate this kind of loving kindness?
Absolutely. They're the people who need it most. Remember, see, this is where when people ask these questions, they find it difficult because they're still referring to Hitler as a bad, evil person.
It's an imperfect person. It's just like me. Being imperfect, we have good.
Yes, an imperfect person because you have good qualities and you have bad qualities.
Exactly.
This is what we need to understand. So, but if we use language like this, then we're stuck. Then we'll say, Hitler doesn't deserve compassion. But see, here's the classic. This is the classic thing: is what do we do in our society? This is the point. Exactly the point. What I'm not going to explain now is what we do in our society. If someone behaves very badly, this is what we do: evil person.
Yes.
We punish the person. Does that work? No. Statistics show, and that's what we unfortunately do: is when people commit a crime, we punish the person. Our penal system is punishing people. And statistics show if we punish people, they statistically come out worse. So we're actually creating people who behave more badly.
But we can deter the potential.
Exactly. That's what I'm coming to now.
Okay.
So by punishing people through cognitive fusion, it actually makes things worse. What we need to do is have the correct perspective. And if someone is misbehaving, we punish the crime, not the person. So if someone is being very harmful in society, of course we need to take them out of society to protect society and then punish the crime by rehabilitating or trying to rehabilitate the person. That's the bet. And statistics show if we use that approach, we have a much better result.
It's very expensive.
Actually, statistics show, this is more expensive. This is the least expensive. Example, and this was really nice, in Norway, because if we have maximum security, hugely expensive. A lot of staff, a lot of guards, a lot of technology.
No, what I'm saying.
Wait, let me just finish. So, maximum security, very expensive. So, in Norway, what they're doing is this. So they have a maximum security prison where they're doing this. They have no bars, no fence. No one tries to escape. Not one person has tried to escape because they're doing this. Because the prisoners see their being compassionate, that they're trying to be rehabilitated. So actually it's least, much less expensive and much better result.
But they have cognitive impairment. They won't have the wisdom or the intelligence to understand the compassion. That's why they commit some of the crimes. Some people, they commit crimes that are mentally ill.
Correct. So therefore, if in the rehabilitation, the ones that don't have mental impairment will learn, and that's what's happening, and they come out a better person. The people who have mental impairment who will not learn, they need to keep them protected from society, maybe for the rest of their life, with compassion. Exactly.
How does, say, regards to good actions?
Very good point. Exactly. I was hoping someone would bring this up. Same problem.
Especially with regard to guru devotion.
Same problem. And that's exactly the point. I was going to bring it up, but I was hoping someone would bring up the question. In our society, we tend to focus on the negative with cognitive fusion, and we end up with a mess. Cognitive fusion is sort of ground into us since we're this high, unfortunately. So we also tend to do it on the positive, and that can also lead to lots of problems. For example, what happens? Let's say a person is doing a good behavior. What we do is we do cognitive fusion. There's a good person. And what do? We praise them, don't we? You're a wonderful person, fantastic person. What does that generally do? Oh, yes, I'm fantastic. I'm wonderful. In fact, I'm better than everyone else.
And it breeds attachment for us as well.
So it helps to breed arrogance, self-cherishing, and it actually is not very compassionate to do that.
Yeah.
But the solution is not to stop praising. The solution is to stop cognitive fusion. If we do this, the correct perspective, and if they've engaged in some good behavior, we praise the behavior. That what you did was fantastic. That behavior is great. Then that encourages them to continue to do that.
You can see how you, with regard to relationships, you often dwell on the good characteristics. And explode them and make them much bigger than they actually are.
Exactly. See, what happens is we've got this epidemic. And so solution or supposed solution, let's do the opposite. Oh, you're a wonderful person. You're like the child. You're special. I mean, a disaster. I mean, one, if you keep telling a child they're special, they'll probably get this big head thinking they're better than everyone else.
Look what it's done to his holiness.
And of course, what happens is they can never live up to that label of special, so then they crash even further. Then they end up with more low self-esteem because they're not special. They must be the opposite, not special. Yeah. So they end up with a low self-esteem. And this is exactly the same scenario for ourselves. If we have done a bad behavior, that's the correct perspective. Simply acknowledge, I've done a harmful behavior. We don't do that usually. I'm a bad person. So same thing. We end up attacking ourselves. I'm a bad person. Beat ourselves up. We can't even acknowledge our good qualities because I'm a bad person. I don't deserve forgiveness or compassion because I'm a bad person. Yeah. So this is where low self-esteem and self-hatred comes from. So same thing, though, on the positive. If we do a good behavior, don't go, I'm a good person, I'm a fantastic person, because we're just going to get a big head. Do this. Yeah. Praise our behavior. Rejoice in our good behavior. Oh, yes, I'm very happy I did that wonderful thing today. I'm going to continue to do that again tomorrow. So if we have the correct perspective with ourselves and others, whether it's positive or negative, the best result. The best result. Same point here, one more point on this. Again, there seems to be an epidemic of guilt in our modern society. Where does guilt come from? If we've done something harmful and we feel guilty, what are we focusing on? Bad me. So guilt comes from cognitive fusion. Useless. It just paralyzes us, makes us feel bad. Completely useless. Whereas if we've done something harmful and we regret, what are we focusing on? I have done a harmful thing. We're regretting our behavior. So regret is coming from a correct perspective. Guilt is coming from the wrong perspective, from cognitive fusion. So if we can sort out this cognitive imbalance, then that's going to go a long way to help support us in the other main aspect of practice, the emotional balance. Any more questions on this?
The guru devotion, you tend perhaps come to fusion can be quite extreme in that, at that point.
Exactly.
And yeah, well, I know whatever I, however I praise my guru, it's not going to make them big-headed because they're beyond them, that sort of behaviour. But it sort of is.
Yeah, of course.
It's my behaviour that's.
So, regardless of who we're relating to, whether it's ourself or anyone else, if we do cognitive fusion, we're leaving ourselves open for a lot of difficulties. And it's an invalid perspective.
Yeah.
Invalid perspective.
And that's a good reason to choose your gurus carefully as well.
That's another point as well in terms of wisdom.
Is cognitive fusion a recognized concept in Western psychology?
Yeah, absolutely. Not that I'm in great psychology training, but that's where I first heard about it, that term. But here, of course, and maybe just a little comment on this, is that, and this ties in also with the cognitive training, is that the idea of the cognitive dysfunction is... One thing is that we identify ourselves with our body, our mind, and so forth. No, this is me. Don't we say that? This is me. But to use a simple example, cup. Isn't cup a label that we're applying to that basis to make some sense or meaning? So we have the basis and then the label. Yeah. Is the label the basis, or are we applying the label to the basis? They're not the same thing, are they? Are they?
No.
But we apply the label to the basis to make sense or meaning. So correctly, we should say cup is something I'm labeling on this basis. But what we say is this is a cup. Another case of cognitive fusion. We fuse the label to the basis. So that's cognitive imbalance.
You couldn't have more than one language if it was identical.
But the label is not the basis. So another difficulty, and this ties in with a little bit the impermanence thing, the basis is changing moment by moment. The label cup, does that change moment by moment, the label? No. If we fuse the two together, suddenly this becomes very static. Because cup is a static concept in our mind. So that also helps to feed the grasping. But also, back here, is we tend to identify ourselves with something in the basis. You know, often our body or mind. You know, this is me. Either we are our body or we have a body. Do we have a body or are we the body? We have a body. Either we are our mind or we have a mind. I think we have a mind. Similarly, we identify ourselves with our thoughts, emotions. You know, some anger is coming up in the mind. I'm an angry person. No such thing. There's just a person who has some anger arising in the mind. But if we identify with that, we're in trouble. You know, how often when people identify with their anger, I'm an angry person, that's me, you've got to accept that. And they feel stuck, don't they? Because we've identified ourselves with anger, we're stuck. Whereas if we simply acknowledge, oh yes, I have a strong habit of getting angry, I'm not anger, but I have a strong habit of getting angry, then we have some breathing space and we can work with anger, which is an object. It's not the subject. It's not me. It's something I have. I have a strong habit of being angry. It's not me. And when I was mentioning this, I remember once, some years ago, in the audience, there was a lady who had two very young children, I think 3 and 4. And she said, oh, yes, I use that technique with my kids. And she said that when they used to start to get angry, she used to say to them, look, there's that anger thing in your mind again. And that forced the child to see anger as an object rather than identifying with it. She said it was very helpful. If she caught it early enough, she said when she said that, it forced them to step back and go, what, what? And diffuse the anger. Stops them from identifying and getting caught up in the anger. So again, if a child is misbehaving and getting angry and saying, you're angry, disaster. Absolute disaster. Rather, use language like that. You know, look, you've got some anger coming up in your mind again. That actually could be very helpful for the child to go, what's this thing? What's she talking about? And then if you can see anger as an object, you won't get caught up in it. Similarly with ourselves is either we are our thoughts or we have thoughts. Either we are our emotions or we have emotions. So if we can stop doing cognitive fusion and see them as things arising in our mind, so that goes back also to the attention training, that attention training using the mind as the object, very helpful for this. Because if we can do the attention training looking at the mind, we can experientially see thoughts, emotions, memories as objects arising in our mind. And we can start to relate to them in that way rather than fusing with them, identifying with them and getting caught up in them. Question?
I was just going to ask what stops us from being complacent. Once we've said, okay, well, I'm distanced from my behaviour in that sense because we're not distanced from it, but I think we relinquish ownership. That's not me, that's my behaviour. And I think we don't want an aversion to that behaviour because we know we shouldn't have aversions to it.
So, see, again, the problem is we're stuck here and so we don't understand this. So how do we overcome this is we distance ourselves. In fact, that's exactly what we do. We suppress. I'm not a bad person. Not me. I didn't do it. I'm not a bad person. So that's the other extreme.
Or then we say, it wasn't me, it was the behaviour. The behaviour is not bad, so I haven't really got any control of that because it's not me.
But that's also cutting from it. See, that's also part of emotional, as it's described here, emotional balance, is while remaining with experience. And that is, often when we're in that state, we get caught up and we get carried away, overwhelmed, or we don't know how to deal with it, we suppress or cut.
So you have to actually be present with it.
So therefore, to be present with it is going to make it a lot easier if we do the correct perspective. Because here, we're not talking about cutting or separating or distancing. In fact, with this, we are fully 100% present, fully. What we do now, of course, is either identify or distance. They're the two extremes we need to avoid. So we need to understand here that saying things like, it wasn't me, it was the behaviour, is still another form of cognitive fusion in a negative sense. Anything else from this? As you can see, it's one of my pet topics. But I think it can be quite helpful. Okay. One more thing I'd like to go back here then with these four immeasurables is we are using those to overcome the imbalances. And some of these imbalances are sort of the direct opposite. For example, the direct opposite of equanimity is this cold indifference, not the cold indifference, the direct opposite of, you know, loving kindness and compassion is like hatred and so forth. So they're easily remedied, you know. But here, there are what's called the near enemy. We have something that sort of looks like this, but actually it's an imbalance and it pollutes these qualities. We need to become aware of that and to try to get that out of there as much as possible. The example we've already looked at is loving kindness. What's called the near enemy of loving kindness is something that looks like loving kindness, but actually its opposite is attachment. So we are to distinguish loving kindness from attachment and try to eliminate the attachment part. So attachment's the near enemy because it sort of looks like loving kindness, but actually it's harmful. So each one of these has what's called a near enemy. But fortunately, one of the other four immeasurables can help us to overcome the near enemy. So if we work on them together, we can really help to overcome all of the near enemies. So just to mention those now very briefly. So the near enemy of loving kindness, of course, is attachment. So we had a look at that. How to use one of the other four immeasurables to help us to reduce that and get rid of that, of course, is if we notice our loving kindness is being polluted by attachment, then we can start to work and cultivate equanimity. Because equanimity, remember, is a mind of equal attitude towards others, overcoming attachment to friends, apathy to strangers, hostility, anger, hatred, difficult people. So again, if we see attachment polluting or coming into loving kindness, then cultivating equanimity can help to eliminate that. But also equanimity can degenerate or have a near enemy, because here this is we're talking about an equal attitude towards everyone, but here, of course, we can be equally indifferent to everyone. So if we see our equanimity sort of degenerating into just being equally indifferent to everyone, then what can really help to overcome the indifference is to reflect and cultivate compassion. Because if we cultivate, reflect on compassion for ourselves and others, it's very difficult to remain indifferent. But then sometimes with our compassion, it can become quite overwhelming. You know, with this sort of, we often end up with this sense of desperation or despair. And often that comes because, again, in our modern society, we tend to always focus on the negative, and it all becomes very overwhelming. Everything's so heavy and negative. So to help, if we find compassion turning into this state of despair, then very helpful is now to reflect on empathetic joy, to focus on the positive aspects of ourselves and others. So that can be a very good remedy to despair. And then this empathetic joy sometimes can also degenerate into, remember, this is a rejoicing in others' virtues and good fortune, but this empathetic joy, this rejoicing can become quite meaningless or frivolous. And sometimes we even start to rejoice about negative things that happen to others. So if we see our empathetic joy degenerating into being frivolous or even maybe harmful rejoicing, then very good to reflect on loving kindness, the wish for ourselves and others to have happiness and its causes. So we can see that each one of these, the near enemy, is effectively counteracted by one of the other four measurables. So they can work very well together as a whole to avoid these degenerations. Any questions about this?
Is it always in this order?
Well, it's a circular thing, isn't it? Yeah, it's not a really an order. Okay, so that's basically the emotional balance. But actually what we need to understand a little bit here is from a Buddhist perspective, these things are not really emotions. These are what's underlying the emotions. So by cultivating these healthy attitudes, we're effectively then cultivating emotional stability, healthy emotions. Because actually, in Buddhist psychology, we don't even really have the word emotion. Because in Buddhism, again, what is key is what's underlying. What are the underlying intentions or aspirations? That's the key. And so therefore, these are referring to the underlying intentions or aspirations rather than how they are expressed in our behavior. So just to finish off today's workshop, I'd like to go back to the overall diagram here that we were looking at. We've been looking at how to cultivate a state of well-being by cultivating these four types of balance, mental balance. And again, the well-being we're talking about is a state of inner well-being, genuine happiness. It's a state of happiness that does not require any particular stimulus to be present. And we saw in this model that the first element was motivational balance, that the initial emphasis, of course, is to try to fix up our aspirations for happiness, because if we have dysfunctional aspirations, if we're, for example, aspiring to things that are not going to bring us happiness, then these elements here, well, we might as well forget about them. So therefore, initially, we need to put some work into developing healthy aspirations or desires for our own and others' happiness. And then on that basis, we can start to develop our attentional balance, our attention skills. Because without these attention skills, we're not going to really be able to develop any cognitive or emotional balance. Because as long as our mind is caught up in dullness and distraction, it's very hard to work with these two elements here. So on the basis of developing these attention skills, which of course bring enormous benefit directly, here we're talking about a much more calm, clear, focused mind. So we'll be less agitated, less stressed, more effective in everything we do and so forth. On that basis, we can really turn our attention to developing cognitive balance and emotional balance. And again, to cultivate these in tandem. In the emotional balance, of course, here we're primarily talking about developing these healthy aspirations for ourselves and others, loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity. And of course, if we can cultivate these, plus if we can cultivate the cognitive balance, that will feed back into improving our motivations. So also, if we even develop attentional skills, that's going to help us also there. So what we can actually find is that even though there is this sort of order in which they are, each one is the basis of the next one, they will feed back into themselves, into all the others. So it really is a very much integrated whole. And if we leave out any one of these elements, you'll find it very difficult to really cultivate any sort of well-being, because each one has a unique part to play in that role. And again, as I mentioned briefly earlier, is unfortunately, in many Buddhist traditions, the attentional training, even though in the text it's mentioned as one of the key practices, when you look at what people are doing in various Buddhist traditions, this seems not to really get emphasized. Different traditions emphasize different aspects, but this often tends to get sort of left out a little bit. And therefore, if we don't have developed a very stable and clear mind, it's very difficult to develop any sort of cognitive balance or emotional balance, or from a Buddhist perspective, of course, Vipassana practice and loving kindness, compassion practice. They become almost impossible to develop to any level, because our mind is just caught up in dullness and distraction and our old habits. So this is the model that we have used today. And again, the traditional model in the Buddhist traditions is this. And we can see how they relate. Because, of course, the cognitive balance is relating a lot to the wisdom, the attentional balance to the concentration, and then the emotional balance, of course, into the compassion wing. They tie in very closely. And also, of course, motivational balance as well. I mean, and also cognitive balance ties in with ethics. So there are a number of different ways in which we can package the Buddhist spiritual path. And what I think what Alan's done here in this article is try to package this in a format that is sort of more understandable within the field of psychology. So it's sort of his attempt to, as he said in the title of his article, to build bridges between psychology and Buddhism. And I think a lot of work is being done in this area in the last years, and I think that psychology has a lot to offer, and I think if we can work together to build those bridges more, I think then we can develop even a more effective system for people to use in their modern-day worlds. So that's all I really wanted to talk about today. We've nearly run out of time, but we've got still a little bit of time if anyone has any last questions from anything today. If there's no questions, then maybe we'll wrap it up there. So I'd just like to finish by, first of all, thanking Jumyoung Leeds for inviting me here and hosting me so well and looking after me. And then, of course, I'd like to thank all of you for coming along, taking the time and effort to come here today. And I hope you've got something out of today's discussion. And I also hope to be coming back in the not-too-distant future. In fact, I think March sometime I'm coming back. So I'll see you back here in March. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.